Hi, gorgeous. I just wanted to say hi and tell you that you're an amazing woman and I love you. All right, bye. The last recorded speech with Brian was a telephone message he left for his girlfriend Alexis the same night he went missing. Hi, and welcome to the first part of a Brian Schaefer story, a narrative. Later in this episode, we'll listen to that message. Brian Schaefer's case is regarded as one of the most baffling and mysterious stories out there. Where to even begin unraveling what might have happened to him? It's almost as if the title, Vanished into Thin Air, seems hand-tailored for this young man's disappearance. Perhaps you've already made up your mind as to what happened, or you might be completely clueless. The answers are as scarce today as they were back then when he vanished. We must remember that the police investigation, which started more than 15 years ago, has yet to provide any clues as to Brian's whereabouts. Whether he's dead or still alive, the investigators haven't given a hint of what they think might have happened to him. They've conveyed over the years that they worked his case around three possible theories, but never mentioned what these theories were about. They are adamant, however, that Brian Schaefer left the bar and the building housing the bar that night, but have not yet provided any type of evidence that this is the case. The police forces are ultimately a tool to enforce the law and solve crimes. If nothing of that sort took place, meaning it is not illegal to run away from your life, and if we're not talking about a homicide that night or ensuing weekend, that expectation path will likely lead nowhere in the end. The only thing we can state as fact is that Brian Schaefer is not a fictional character. He stood alive and well, perhaps somewhat inebriated, outside a bar called the Ugly Tuna Saluna at around 2 a.m., and then completely vanished from the face of the earth. This podcast series will, in a number of episodes, explore and recount the few known facts in a progressive and easy-to-comprehend style and in an audio format that mixes other important cases too, but also doesn't leave you, the listeners, completely astray. Some possible answers will be provided in some episodes. What ultimately happened is for you to decide. We will refrain from using small-town gossip posted on social media or the web throughout the years as possible theories, motives, or possible suspects. This series will also host an introductory episode giving general legend facts about this disappearance. Please listen to that episode prior if you're totally unfamiliar with the case or just would like to refresh your memory. The background information there will help out in making more sense of what you will be hearing from now on. My name is Edo LaRosa, and I'll be this series host for the entire duration. In a number of other episodes, we will be joined by other individuals who will contribute with their knowledge, effort, and time in the end to help out and try to provide more answers than we've got in this disappearance. Thank you for subscribing to the series and giving it a rating. Please share it with friends and family and check out the series on Instagram. Nothing else will be asked in return as of now. The more people we have wanting an answer for this med student and the more spread we can give to this disappearance, the easier it will be to ultimately unravel what took place that April Fool's Day in 2006. As mentioned, other disappearances will pop up too as we continue this journey. Hopefully in the end, wiser, more knowledgeable about the case, and hungrier for even more future content.
Thank you.
This case centers around the capital of Ohio and the second largest city in the Midwest, Columbus. However, Brian grew up in the smaller city of Pickerington, considered a suburb located to the east of Columbus, with his mom and dad, Renee and Randy, and younger brother Derek. In the beginning, Brian wasn't overly focused on his academic performance, but was actually more into his athletic capabilities. According to his father, he tried out a lot of different sports, but really excelled and eventually settled for tennis, reaching a point where he was captain of the team and the important finals lay ahead. At one point, the coach told Brian that he had to start thinking about his appearance and that he basically had to cut his hair. Surprisingly or unsurprisingly, Brian let the coach know what he thought of that idea by leaving the club and eventually leaving sports altogether. So Brian probably had a portion of a rebellious character in him, but honestly wasn't the coach familiar with Bjorn Borg, the tennis megastar who was world famous for his long hair. So in the end, that remark perhaps says more about the coach than about Brian. But if you see pictures of Brian, well, we all have these different stages in our lives where we try different appearances. The male population can't do much more than experimenting with different hairstyles and letting the beard or mustache grow. But Brian had a particular thing going for him here and seems to have taken this a step further than the average fella. His images out there are quite different from one another, even considering age progression with facial features almost shifting. A sign of a free-spirited individual? Being born in mid-February certainly brings to mind the description of a typical Aquarius. Every Aquarian is a rebel at heart. These air signs despise authority and anything that represents conventionality. Brian was also really into music, particularly the Seattle-based grunge band Pearl Jam. On Brian's MySpace account, which was the social media platform to use pre-Facebook, originally founded as a venue for aspiring musicians and bands to share music and concert dates, Brian had listed all the groups he liked. Brian also played the guitar himself and was, by all accounts, quite decent at it. Several pictures of Brian show him with a guitar on his knee and a big smile on his face. Eventually heading down the academic path, the contributing factors to his career choice were his mother, Renee, who worked as a nurse and was really appreciated in the community. Carrying out her profession in various hospitals and clinics, even after the treatment of her patients, Renee was known to follow up on them and went to visit them at their home to check on them. You know, she was quite liked, and I think that Brian looked at her and saw her as a role model for himself. And eventually, he chose to go down the same road himself. So he began studying to become a doctor. He took classes in microbiology and studied that for 6 years, and then started his doctor's degree at The Ohio State University College of Medicine. So during this period, of course, financially, the studies are quite burdensome. You don't have a lot of money to spend. Brian mediated this fact by working extra or part-time at a clothing outlet called JCPenney. That's where he actually met his friend Clint Florence for the first time. Clint had been his coworker at the store, but Brian sort of needed financial help to be able to study to become a doctor and also to take care of his daily expenses. So actually, it seems to be that the person who contributed the most towards this aid was his mother. At OSU, Brian met Alexis Wagoner. They were sort of introduced to each other and fell for each other with a lot of respect between them. She was going to be a doctor, and he was going to be a doctor. They spent whatever time they had left after studying together. Alexis mentioned an episode in the beginning, which really made her fond of Brian early on. Not even a week after they had been dating, she had an accident with her car. And although safe from bodily harm, her car broke down and had been stuck at the auto repair shop. But as soon as she needed to go somewhere, Brian had been there for her. He had also taken her out to eat. They went to the movies. She never forgot this period when she had been in that situation. Brian had been by her side from the get-go. So they met sometime in the autumn of 2005. So when Brian disappeared, they had been together for like less than a year. And that Friday, when Brian vanished, so to say, they had had contact with each other. Brian called her at around 10 p.m., but she didn't reply, so he left her a message.
Mm-hmm.
But half an hour later, she called back. Brian mentioned he was out with the boys and had the opportunity to talk about her to them. She recounted afterward that everything sounded fine with Brian. There was nothing apparently wrong. She herself had gone to Toledo to visit her parents. It is said that their dog was quite ill, so she wanted to take the opportunity to say goodbye to the dog in case something happened to the dog. She and Brian were also heading to Florida on the 3rd of April, on that coming Monday. So that's basically the reason that she left Columbus that day and went to Toledo. While being there on that weekend, she started to call Brian to check on him. Brian didn't answer his phone. She thought in the beginning that since Brian had been out drinking and celebrating, that he just needed to rest or sleep. As the unanswered calls kept stacking up, she became more and more worried. She began having these bad vibes that something wasn't right, basically. The first thing she did when she came back to Columbus was that she went over to his apartment to check on him. They actually had their own apartments. They were kind of small, so they had one each. Inside his apartment, everything suggested nothing had happened there, basically. Brian's belongings were still there. The car was parked outside, and no one seemed to have taken a shower. The bathroom hadn't been used. So who knows what went on in her head? She must have been worried sick. She contacted his father, Randy, and also his brother, Derek, got to know about this. So they both head out to the apartment to try to assess what was going on. Derek recounts this moment heading out to Brian's apartment, and in all the anxiety, he felt relieved when arriving at the apartment that the lights were on, indicating Brian was at home. Of course, then he found out it had been Alexis who had turned them on when she looked for Brian. He mentioned that when he saw Brian's eyeglasses on the cupboard, he felt something was really wrong here. In the beginning of March 2006, tragedy had struck the Schaefer family. Renee passed away from cancer. Of course, Brian took it hard. Renee had been particularly ill during Christmas, and she lay in the hospital during Christmas Eve. It must have been awful for him, studying to become a doctor, to see your own mother passing away from an incurable illness like that. Brian passed by to visit her as often as he could, and Renee's last gift to him was that trip they were going to make to Florida. She wanted them to go together and really experience a memorable time together. Brian put a lot of effort into this trip to try to create this wonderful occasion for them. The father recounted when people tried to suggest that Brian could have left everyone by his own intentions that night, he usually reminded them of a Christmas card Brian had written to his mom while she lay in hospital, and Brian had read it to her. "You inspire me to do great things one day." Was that great thing just running away that 1st of April, leaving everyone he loved behind? Randy said. But if we go back to the 31st of March 2006, this was a Friday. It was the start of the spring break holiday. Brian had made some plans for the evening. So he started off by having dinner with his father at a steakhouse outside of Columbus in a place called Reynoldsburg. It was the family's place when they went out to dine this Outback Steakhouse. There is an interview with Randy where he sort of talks about this, that they had the same food that they usually ate. But this time around, Brian actually had a drink, which never happened when he used to go there with his mom. This dinner seems to have been about 1 hour long, roughly. Randy recollects that they came at around 7:30, and by 8:30, Brian was sort of back at the apartment. So after this dinner, well, it's been sort of suggested that Brian headed out to settle the differences that they might have had because there were rumors that they didn't really get along. Brian was offended by something the father supposedly had done. But for me, like an hour is more or less like you meet up, you have something to eat, and then you move on. So I don't know how many conclusions we can draw from this dinner that they had. Randy mentioned that he was kind of upset himself in this sentimental mood because his wife had just perished. Actually, Brian was the one who comforted him. Brian seemed to be doing quite all right, except that Brian had been pulling these all-nighters studying. The whole week leading up to this Friday and doing all sorts of exams, He had basically been studying the whole night, and then in the morning he went back to school. Then he came back home, and then it started again, and so forth the whole week. And of course, on top of that, you have your mother's death, so surely he had a hard time. But by all indications, Brian really looked forward to going out that night, like, as soon as possible. And Randy had this opinion about this. He was thinking, like, why don't you just take it easy after all that's happened these past few weeks? But he didn't want to meddle. That's how it was. So the last exchange between Brian and his father after they met up this evening was that Randy asked Brian to come and help him out the following day on Saturday because Randy needed some help with cleaning out the shed and moving some stuff out of his home now that Renee had passed away. That was the idea in Randy's mind, that he was going to meet Brian on the following day, Saturday. So now continuing the evening, Brian meets up with his friend, Clint. Clint Florence had been his coworker. Then they had been sharing a room together at one point during their studies. Clint had opted for a more scientific role and put in hours working as an assistant professor in the medical field at OSU. So in a sense, Brian and Clint had been pretty close to each other. They were hardly the best friends on Earth, but nowadays they liked each other's company, and at this point, they were more like drinking buddies. Their relationships, as with many others, had these strengths and weaknesses, this model they had accepted between them. Brian was more the alpha male and took more initiatives. Clint was more eloquent and cunning, and the more relaxed guy, he actually enjoyed Clint's company in this manner. It was sort of the perfect partner for him this evening. So actually, Clint meets up with Brian at his apartment because Clint drove his car and actually parked his car near Brian's apartment. Then they begin this stroll towards the bar area, the campus area in downtown Columbus. Brian's apartment was located about 6 blocks away from the first bar that they planned to visit, which was the bar where it all ended. But they headed out to the Ugly Tuna Saluna half an hour later. They end up there and take 3 to 4 shots of liquor each. So they don't stay too long, but they continue this sort of bar hopping from bar to bar. They go to a bar called the Short North, and they stay there for 15 to 20 minutes. Then they head out to a bar called Brothers, one called the Red Star. And actually during this time, Clint actually has some contact with his friend, a woman called Meredith. They actually agree that Meredith is going to pick them up with her car. By this time, when they ended at this last bar, before they were going back to the Ugly Tuna Saluna, they were in a new district close to a new stadium that was built called the Arena District. So they were a couple of miles away from the Ugly Tuna Saluna, where they had planned to finish off the evening. So at a street called Vine Street, she picks them up and she drives them to the South Campus area on High Street, and she eventually parks her car in the designated garage, and then they continue on foot towards the bar. So let me talk a little bit about the bar itself and the area. So previously, this part of downtown Columbus in that proximity to the university campus was actually quite run down. There were a lot of smaller streets with cozy bars and restaurants and the like, but there was also quite a bit of crime going on. So the idea was to sort of enhance this area and to give it a better reputation. So they started to purchase a lot of these properties. They demolished the old buildings and they built anew. So one of these new buildings that were constructed was the South Gateway Complex. This building was the gateway inn to the perimeter of the OSU campus area. The Ugly Tuna Saluna was situated on the second floor. So you had this entrance from the outside street promenade or courtyard on the ground floor. And then you took the escalators up to the next floor and you had the bar entrance on your right side. And if you went to the left, you had this Gateway Cinema, which was the better part of the second floor. Some other properties in other directions inside the complex were still opening up, so parts of the Gateway building were still under construction. Outside of the building, a particular sign adorned the facade. You've probably all seen it by now. The Ugly Tuna Saluna, Fresh Fish Ugly Owners. The idea of the bar was to serve all these university students. They had these huge fish bowls, but also to provide food. So I should mention that when I found out about Brian's case, I've never actually been so much into true crime before. But I was watching many episodes on a true crime YouTube program called That Chapter. So about 20 videos in it just popped up, the disappearance of Brian Schaefer. I actually watched it, and it seemed regularly exciting. I wasn't really overwhelmed by that point. But around that time, the incident with the Saudi dissident Jamal Khashoggi and that whole case was still fresh in my mind. This Washington Post columnist had taken refuge in the US, but had traveled to Turkey, to the consulate in Istanbul, together with his fiancée, to do some paperwork to be able to marry her. He heads over there accompanied by his fiancée, and he enters the building, but fails to exit and was never seen again. The girlfriend who waited outside for him starts to ask questions and sounded the alarm, but the whole case set off a big diplomatic standoff in the region. What happened was that Jamal never left the consulate because he was killed inside. A hit squad of more or less 15 people had landed in a private plane and were waiting for him inside the building. Perhaps a hint of what is necessary to pull off a stunt like this and to be able to conduct a similar operation. But I was really taken by this incident. Then it came to my mind that this individual, Brian Schaefer, he had entered the bar but is never seen leaving. So I made this connection immediately. So I wanted to check things out to have some background info on how this happened. When I started to check things out, I was stuck. So that's how it began. So in the beginning, I was curious, and I set out with the idea that something happened to Brian inside the bar. So the layout of the bar, and if something had transpired in there, got my primary attention. But I met some hurdles directly because this bar now, it turned out, was situated inside another building. And it looked like the bar was kind of small also for something major to have happened in there. So this building, the South Gateway Complex, was basically big like a whole block. The main streets outside were heavily trafficked. It's called High Street. To be able to reach the so-called Gateway building entrance, you walked on this traffic-free street promenade that had other places and shops along the way. Midway, you had the Gateway entrance, and further down, you came to the parking garage. Passing the corner of the building, this side was considered the back of the building where the loading docks were located. And there was a back exit on this side where businesses like the Ugly Tuna Saluna could manage the deliveries that went to the bar. Passing the building to the opposite corner led you to the outside part of where a large store was being set up, the Sunflower Market. This market was directly opposite the Wendy's restaurant that was located across the street at the time. Returning to the courtyard area, some of these places that were situated on this ground courtyard outside the Gateway entrance had cameras of their own. The other side by the market was more in the shadow. Construction at the time was conducted along all the ground floor spaces of the building. A safe path, if you will, a hallway led you from within the building to the back exit, and to be able to conduct this construction there, two large outside entrances were set up, one of which was located by the Jim and John restaurant by the courtyard adjacent to the Gateway entrance. And the other one was located opposite side of Wendy's restaurant by this Sunflower Market. Continuing from where we left off, what's also mentioned in connection to Brian's case was the MedMax restaurant, which was directly beneath the terrace. The Ugly Tuna Saluna had a terrace that ran all along one side of the bar. Patrons could exit to the terrace to get some fresh air and sit outside. You could have jumped down from this terrace, but you would have been noticed because you ended up on this crowded street promenade and you would have hit yourself on the roof of the outdoor sitting for the MedMax restaurant. So the bar itself, when you entered, you had this square-shaped room, and in the middle was the bar desk with benches, tables, and stools on the sides. The kitchen was on the left, not particularly big, and in the upper right corner you had the black painted stage where the live band played. And I remember reading a comment on Reddit that Brian could have hidden under the stage until the bar closed and then something happened from there, but the stage was sort of diagonal in shape, quite small actually. I managed to find some pictures, and for a person to crawl under there and hide, Brian was around 6'2", so no. And on that side, you also had the terrace that I previously mentioned. Also looking further into his case, there seemed to be talk of an emergency exit. It made me wonder where it was, where it led, because basically my conclusion that Brian met with foul play in the bar didn't seem to add up. So I became even more intrigued by the fact that Brian must have left somehow. So looking more into the emergency exit, if that could have been a way out, I was able to find more information about it. This emergency exit was located on your right side when entering this square-shaped room, which was the bar itself, really. But there was a lot of comments about the emergency exit door. There was an alarm that was supposed to go off, so the staff inside the bar were supposed to be notified if someone opened this door. But if you got out of this emergency exit door or fire escape, you passed a hallway emergency stairs, but then you ended up at an exit adjacent to the downstairs gateway entrance. You basically got back to where you were from the beginning. Moreover, these emergency exit doors on street level were monitored by a CCTV camera on the opposite side of the street that was supposed to zoom in if these doors were opened. Evidently, the zoom function had been overridden. The ugly tuna staff, what they told the detectives was that they had placed someone outside to watch over this exit. So if someone was to exit this way, the staff would have known about this. And they told the detectives that that evening no one exited the bar that way. In conjunction with this, there was an older webpage that was created by a woman called Lori Davis, which is a very affluent person in the Brian Schaefer case. She's basically been keeping his mystery and disappearance alive throughout all these years. She was a person who got to know Randy. She saw him on an interview on television, and she couldn't stop thinking of his son, Brian. And she felt sorry for Randy and his son's disappearance. So she got in contact with him, and she helped him out a lot, like a lot. They actually became dear friends after this. So Lori created all these websites, and the most prominent is the one called findbrianschaefer.com. But there were earlier versions also that I examined, and there was this comment section. And one comment was, if the detectives involved in the search for Brian had been aware that there was a camera in one of the coffee shops located on the opposite side of the entrance of the gateway complex, because there could have been some footage of Brian there. And the reply from Lori was that, yes, actually the detectives had shared this footage with Randy already, and that they could rule out basically two things: that he didn't exit the gateway entrance by means of taking the escalators down because he wasn't captured on video outside the entrance. And also, they could rule out that he didn't leave by means of taking the emergency exit, because the emergency exit was adjacent to the entrance, and he would have been picked up by the same footage if that had been the case. So talking about the emergency exit, I feel there's an urgency to end this episode, and I will continue at a later date with the release of part two. There's a ton more to cover with the bar closing, the footage, which way Brian eventually headed out, the searches. So make sure to subscribe to the series, spread the word to family and friends, and I'll see you in the next one. Bye.